Welcome to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Bringing you enlightened discussions with authors, creatives, innovative business and health professionals, and ordinary people living extraordinary lives. Sharing their expertise and life stories. Making a difference, one word at a time. Now here's your host, Vicki St. Clair.
And welcome, everyone. Welcome. Boy, am I glad to be here this morning. It's been one of those mornings I wasn't sure I was going to get here. But, you know, over the past 10 years, I was thinking, I've talked with hundreds of doctors who say that almost no one escapes a major trauma in their life at some point. So the question we begin with today is, do traditional trauma treatments work? And my first guest, Dr. Alicia Salza, says an emphatic no. In most cases, they do not work, but she's here to tell us about a whole new way of dealing with life's traumas, how to get over your past, no matter how traumatic, with resilience, strength, and optimism. I'll introduce her in just a moment. I'll also be talking with the producer and screenwriter of TV's X-Files, Buffy the Vampire Slayer, and the series 24. Howard Gordon always dreamed of being a novelist. You'd think with all that success, he'd made his dream, but he still had another dream there, and that was to be a novelist. And after 26 years in Hollywood and a screenwriter's strike, he found the time to write Gideon's War, which is hailed as an exciting, nonstop thrill ride. And coming up this Saturday, right here in Bellevue, the Northwest Parkinson's Foundation presents the 2011 Wellness Conference, The Power of Your Mind, Your Thoughts Affect How You Feel. That's going to be right here in Bellevue, as I said, and we'll be sharing more details about that later in today's show. Did you know that over 70,000 people in the Northwest have Parkinson's disease? It's quite amazing. I've been to one of their conferences before. I'm going to this one on Saturday, and we'll tell you more about that later on. But first, I'm very pleased to welcome Dr. Alicia Salza to the show. She obtained her medical degree from Cornell University and completed her BA at the University of Pennsylvania. She's held posts at UCLA, Columbia University, and the Mount Sinai School of Medicine, before becoming the director of aftercare for the Montel Williams Show in 2003. She appeared in over 100 episodes, helping victims overcome trauma by implementing revolutionary positive psychology exercises and techniques, and we'll learn more about those today. She's an advocate for victims of psychological trauma. Fantastic resume here. I mean, she's served on the Speakers Bureau of the Rape, Abuse, Incest National Network. She's volunteered for Disaster Psychiatry Outreach, an organization which provides free mental health staffing and treatment in the aftermath of disasters such as 9/11. And she volunteered at Ground Zero at the Family Assistance Center after the September 11th attacks. She worked there for 3 years at that clinic. And she's written a great new book. It's called Back to Life, Getting Past Your Past with Resilience, Strength, and Optimism. Dr. Alicia Salza, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Well, this is a great book, Dr. Salza, for many reasons. I've done shows in the past and received calls from listeners or emails, and they've stuck in my mind, particularly when somebody's had a very traumatic experience. They've said things like, well, you know, your guest gave great information today, but my situation is really different. I've had terrible trauma in my life, and I just can't get past it, and I can't find anything that helps me. And I think one of the reasons maybe is because you say that the traditional or the existing practices that people use to treat trauma just don't work.
Well, you know, it's not just terrible trauma that sometimes sticks with you forever. It's also, you know, we all have that girlfriend who had a terrible divorce or someone betrayed them years ago, and we look at them and we say, wow, what a wonderful person, but she's just stuck. She just can't move past the anger and the bitterness. And you see the very permanent toll that sometimes a life event like that can take, whether it's what you think of as a big T trauma or whether it's one of those other curveballs that life slings you. And it became very clear to me in my field that what we're trained, our offerings in therapy, are really limited and really don't work for everyone. And there's an enormous number of people who just continue to have symptoms and have their therapy focus on their symptoms. What they really want is to figure out how to feel good again, how to trust again, how to love again, how to feel safe again. And that's what this book is really about.
You say that trauma narrows our emotional bandwidth, and that, as you said, most of us do carry trauma around, whether it's, as you call it, the big T trauma or the little T trauma. And depending on how much unhealed trauma we carry, it affects our ability to love and feel lovable, to stick up for ourselves, to take risks, to feel hopeful. Tell us how your book differs from many of the books on the bookshelves today.
Well, when I read most of the books that are out there that discuss trauma, post-traumatic stress disorder, how to overcome these things, I find that many of them, most of them, invite us to reflect on the past, to revisit the past, to describe what we've been through, to rekindle all that old stuff. And I have an issue with that, because what I find is that a lot of people, well, first of all, have been doing that for years and years and years with various therapists, reading books, and trying to heal on ourselves. And for the most part, we wouldn't still be here if that had worked. For many people, you know, that's just supposed to be cathartic in some way. But for many people, it's not. It's just not. All it does is pick at a scab and open up this old wound. And then my feeling, this is my gripe with my own profession, is then what? How do we teach people to contain emotions that threaten to become overwhelming? How do we teach people when anxiety, depression starts to well up, that you're in charge of your emotional landscape and that you can actually create and kindle a different emotion in yourself if you know how? We don't spend a lot of time in our you look at heroic overcomers. If you look at the people who seem to glide through these incredibly difficult, challenging events, you see that that's actually what they're doing. They are taking an enormous discipline over the thoughts that they allow in their head and the feelings they allow in their heart. And when they start to feel a certain way, whereas the rest of us would either hit the ice cream or start to spiral, they know what to do to get themselves feeling differently. And that's really interesting to me. That's, to me, in all these years of working on the Montel Show or at Ground Zero, that to me is the moment when I want to jump in that person's head and say, what are you doing differently? And that moment is what Back to Life is all about. The book really, and the approach that I take is concrete. It really offers you skills to say, in that moment when I'm spiraling and feeling lousy, how do I catch myself and what do I do differently?
Yeah, and we're going to take a look at that. We are live. We're having a little kickback on your call-in line here. So I think we're going to go to break and we're going to try and call you back, Dr. Salsa, see if we can get a better line. Please do stay with us. We're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. My guest is Dr. Alicia Salsa. Her book is called Back to Life, Getting Past Your Past with Resilience, Strength, and Optimism. Please stay with us.
Parkinson's disease affects as many as 1 million people in the United States. At the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, it's our mission to beat this disease. To learn about the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, or if you want to help support our work, visit our website, pdf.org, or call us at 800-457-6676. In the Northwest, contact the Northwest Parkinson's Foundation at nwpf.org.
Intuitive dream coach Joyce Chapman says there are no little dreams, that every desire is important, and that you deserve life to its fullest. As a dream activist, Joyce has helped thousands of people gain clarity about their lives and make positive changes. She can help you too. See more information at joycechapman.com. And if you have a question for Joyce regarding your dream, email joyce@joycechapman.com. Coming next week on Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair, trauma psychiatrist Dr. Alicia Salzer offers advice on overcoming life's most difficult challenges. And longtime 24 executive producer Howard Gordon talks with Vicky about his thrilling debut novel, Gideon's War. Join us February 28th at noon Pacific on Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. See more at conversationslive.net.
You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Making a difference, one word at a time.
Get your smile on with Alternative Talk 1150. A long time coming, but I know a change gonna come.
And welcome back. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. And we just reconnected with Dr. Alicia Salza. Hopefully we've got a better line now. I think we do have. Welcome back, Dr. Salza.
Thank you so much. Nothing like staticky advice.
Well, you know, this happens when we go live. It's a risk we take. But you've got such good information. We can hear you better now, hopefully. So we'll get that out to our listeners. So we talked about how different your work is. You know, you don't agree in going back and revisiting this pain because it can actually keep us stuck in that. I loved this analogy in your book. You said you can't live well on junk food, you can't live well on the bad feelings brought on by your trauma. So let's start looking at some of the techniques that you use. You talked about positive psychology and resilience. Where does one start with this? A huge question.
It's a huge one, but it's a good one. And I don't know if, in general, people are aware that there's a revolution brewing in the therapeutic world. And that is really the study of what makes people feel good, what makes people feel that their lives are worth living and that they are enriching and that we're growing and that they're meaningful and that we're going to leave our mark in the world in a substantial way. And this is fascinating because in therapy, we're usually focused on helping people feel from a -5 to a 0. So then once you get to that nice 0, we feel that we've got a success. But positive psychology is all about the science of what makes us feel good. And never before, to my knowledge, has anyone taken that knowledge and actually tried to apply it directly to people who are trying to overcome a traumatic event or to get past a life event. So for me, this is about realizing all of the wonderful emotions that we don't get enough of. I mean, we all say, oh, I've been stressed all week. I've been exhausted all week. I'm kind of down all week. But to actually say, well, you know, I've been feeling so grateful or I've been feeling so serene all week, people start to wonder what you spiked your Wheaties with, right? I mean, there's almost a bias in our community against that. And people start to think that it's kind of Pollyanna or sugar-coated. And my feeling is, no, it's really not. That the people who get to feel those things are not feeling them by accident. They're working at it. And they may be making it look easy. But you don't get to feel those things in general unless you make a point of saying, you know, I'm going to figure out what gets me a dose of those, and I'm going to prioritize that in my life. They say, you know, in the world of dieting, that if you don't stock the fridge with healthy snacks, with carrots and celery, when the moment comes that you're feeling badly, you're not going to have something healthy to reach for. And so in Back to Life, I like to describe some things that you can cultivate for yourself so that when you start to feel badly, you have something healthy already pre-planned that you're going to reach for instead of what your old habit is. Now, a lot of the book is very creative. It's very spiritual. So some of those things might be artistic or might be musical. And these aren't things that you would normally reach for when you're feeling down. But if you know that that's what makes you tick, you'll find that there are many heroes throughout history, whether it's Nelson Mandela or Rosa Parks, who actually did specifically use music as like a pill to pop when they were feeling badly.
Right.
And that's
right.
Fascinating, right?
It is. And I wanted to say, on your website, you have a whole page dedicated to various forms of music to use under different conditions. And we're actually using that. We use that to play you in and out of break.
That's so cool.
And we'll use some more of it to play you out of this segment, too. But if listeners want to go to your website, then they can find that music on there. And you just click and you can play this music, which I think is great. Because I think music is has huge healing powers for people.
The website is backtolifebook.com, and the playlists are not just feel-good, happy things. You know, sometimes what you need to get in touch with is something subtler, like, I need to get good and angry about this, or I'm going through a breakup, and instead of listening to the melancholy mix, I need to listen to those entitled, I didn't need him anyway, I can do better songs. And so, you know, an invitation in the book to actually pause and say, what do you need more of? If you had a best friend, if you had the ultimate therapist there in your corner to talk you up and cheer you on, what emotion would they be giving you a dose of? And how can you get some of that for yourself?
I know when I need to get revved up, I listen to Eminem or Jimi Hendrix or Led Zeppelin. That always revs me up for some reason. But yeah, I hear what you're saying on that. You say that part of the pain we feel is mourning, that we're mourning the loss of our former selves. I wonder if you'd talk a little about that.
Well, I think that we tell ourselves a lot of stories about the way that we're changed forever by the things that we've experienced. And that's all well and good to say, you know, he robbed my innocence, or I'll never trust again. Until you look around you and you realize that there are people who went through similar things and somehow got their innocence back. So, you know, the book is full of challenges, and this is why I use a lot of examples of heroes that you've heard of from pop culture or from, you know, icons of overcoming from history, because I want people to know that even if you think there's something that a person can't get past, and I like to say getting past your past, not getting over, because, you know, as Elizabeth Edwards said, you lose a son, you don't get over that. It's kind of how do you learn how to walk on one leg? People do it, and, you know, she did it. She did it with an admirable amount of resilience and strength and courage, and in her autobiographies breaks down what she actually did to try to cope better. So, you know, this to me is just so fascinating. I think that we can't buy into the belief system that we are changed forever, yes, perhaps, but maybe even for the better. Because I find that trauma survivors are a really wonderful tribe of people who know what matters in life and who are touched by other people and who are very real and who have an incredible insight in many ways. Yeah. But I don't buy into the fact that we're changed forever for the worse.
Right. Well, a great example you gave is Charlize Theron, the actor who her mother, I remember reading about this many years ago, but you mentioned this in the book too. Charlize was just 15 when her mother shot and killed her father, who I guess was abusive. And that happened right in front of Charlize. And the learning there to Charlize was that she learned the value of life.
Right. And if you make a study of really heroic overcomers, you find that one way or another, even if it seems like a stretch to you, they find meaning in what they went through. And often the meaning that they find is that, wow, you know, when your husband's cheated, suddenly you really have an appreciation for what it means to have someone be loyal. Or, you know, when you've had a child become sick, suddenly you have such an appreciation for the magic of a body that works well. And in the book, part of what we do in Back to Life is we wrap our heads around what we've been through, and we find a way to focus not on the negatives that have come from it, but the gifts that are hidden in it. And even Viktor Frankl, who survived the Holocaust, found gifts in this experience that opened his eyes to a different kind of appreciation, a different way of life. There's so much to be learned from these people. But the main thing that you learn is that it is not an accident, that this is really almost a mental discipline,
right.
A spiritual mental discipline that you cultivate. But all of this sounds quite heavy, and I don't want to give the impression that it's a heavy read, because Back to Life is actually a fun book. It's very workbooky, and there are a lot of fun exercises to reflect on yourself. It's creative and spiritual, and you get to take these kind of quizzes where you learn things about yourself that you didn't know and find ways to make out of them coping skills that work better for you than what you're doing today.
Yeah, one of your heroes, I wanted to talk about him, was Dan Palotta. You mentioned him in the book. I guess his business partner committed suicide, which left Dan pretty devastated, but he turned his action or his grief into action.
Yeah, you know, people like Dan are so remarkable, because what Dan did when his partner committed suicide is he started to organize a suicide walk. And from that, he started to organize other foundations that ultimately raised millions and millions of dollars to raise awareness. And when I see someone like that, I find, you know, you see these icons of industry, and it's so easy to put them up on a pedestal and say, well, that guy's just some kind of powerhouse, you know, corporate sort of guy. I don't know how they do what they do in the business world. But when you talk to Dan, you find that he's a poet and he's a songwriter and he's a sweet, wonderful, brave soul full of heart who just decided that I can grieve, or I can make something of this that honors my friend and that helps other people become aware, and that creates a community of people who've been through something and who we all get this common thing. And in the meantime, to help. So that's just remarkable. And one thing that I really want people to understand about being a survivor of whatever it is you've survived is that every human rights struggle that's ever been was born from people who could have either seen themselves as victims or could have gotten fierce and tried to really think of productive, wonderful things to do. So I do a lot of taking those heroes off pedestals to see the human that, you know, had lousy days and cried and suffered and finally said, you know what, I can't live like this. I will live like this if I don't do something more productive with myself.
Right. You talk about resilience in the book a lot because that's what this is all about. It's about bouncing back. And you talk about efficacy, but you say that efficacy doesn't necessarily apply to effectiveness, but our expectations of our effectiveness. I wonder if you'd explain that a little more.
That sounds complicated, right? Well, it does. Sometimes I hear the psychiatric lingo come back to me and I say, well, this sounds complicated. It's really not. My point here is that at the end of the day, do you think you're in charge of your emotions or do you feel like your emotions wash over you like the weather and they're just something you have to endure? This is one question that I ask in the book and that I ask people to challenge and to experiment a little bit to see how malleable their emotions are when they start to feel badly. The other thing is, in the world, have your life experiences led you to believe that there's no point in trying to make a change or to speak up or to defend yourself because it's not going to make a difference? Because a lot of the times our life experiences have taught us that. And this, too, is something of resilience. You find really resilient people, they believe that their voice matters and they believe they can make a change. And even if they don't, they have the guts to try. So they don't take a passive stance. They're constantly talking to people and meeting people and networking and sharing their story and seeing what might be done. And that's a whole world of opportunity that doesn't open if deep inside some experience of yours led you to believe that activism doesn't help or that, you know, engaging other people in your struggle doesn't help or that complaining to the principal at your kid's school isn't going to help. You know, we can't shut those doors in front of ourselves before we try as adults.
Right. We're almost at the end of our segment, Dr. Salza, but I wanted to talk about this because you say we must reclaim our pleasure. We have a responsibility to reclaim our pleasure. Most of us rein in our happiness. Tell me that's not so.
Well, we do, something wonderful happens, and so many people are just waiting for something to crash and burn. It's really hard to bask in the moment. It's really hard to really learn how to milk the most out of the good things in life. And that's why in Back to Life, I also pull in part of the art of savoring, the science of savoring and of mindfulness. These are sort of Eastern skills that I pull into my practice to help people really understand, hey, when something good happens, how can I plan on good things? How can I share them with good friends? How can I reflect on them and really juice them for all they're worth? And how can I combat my own negativity when I am talking myself out of something wonderful that might happen? We survivors do a lot of that. And a lot of what I talk about in Back to Life is how to shut that voice up and just try to enjoy and try to really enjoy as much as you can in the present.
And a final thought you'd like to leave our listeners with today?
Well, I guess my final thought is just that it's quite easy to think after years of being stuck, of carrying these things with you, that there's nothing that's going to help you change. But my view is this is something fresh to try. It's really something different that has not been offered before, this concept of using positive psychology and resilience as a tool to try and cope better, to try and take back your life. And I just encourage folks to give it a read, give it a try, or buy it and share it with a friend that you know is stuck and could use a creative, spiritual way to move forward.
Yeah, I think that's a great way of describing your book, Creative and Spiritual, with some good common sense in there. I'm no different to anybody else. I've had my own fair share of trauma, and I wish this book had been around then. But I'll keep it in mind for future. Would you give out your website one more time, please, before you leave us?
The website is backtolifebook.com.
Thank you so much, Dr.
Thank
Alicia.
Thank you for having me.
Dr. Alicia Salza, and her book is Back to Life, Getting Past Your Past with Resilience, Strength, and Optimism. And Dr. Oz, the Dr. Oz, says Dr. Salza offers an empowering new approach to trying on the coping skills and outlooks of heroic overcomers. These are life skills we should all have learned as kids. Please do stay with us. We'll be right back with the Northwest Parkinson's Foundation.
In these jeans of his with her name still on it, hey, but I don't care. Cause sometimes I said sometimes I hear my voice and it's been he. Silent all these years go by.
If you missed a show on Conversations Live, check out conversationslive.net for dozens of free podcasts. Topics range from health and healing to business and career growth, from personal development to creativity, adventure, and the challenges of the human spirit. See conversationslive.net for talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Conversationslive.net, making a difference one word at a time.
Do you have legal questions? Need to know where to turn?
Hi, this is Rick Gregrick, your host of Northwest Legal Compass.
Northwest Legal Compass will address your questions on a variety of legal topics, including estate planning, asset protection, real estate and business planning, and more. The legal and accounting staff of Gregrick and Associates are dedicated to providing you with superior legal and tax services. Their integrated counsel is geared to the achievement of your goals.
Visit us on the web at rjglegal.com.
Be sure and tune in every Friday at noon here on Alternative Talk 1150.
You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to help you heal and stay healthy.
Conscious living for conscious people. Alternative Talk 1150.
Somebody else to understand. Years go by if I'm stripped of my beauty and the orange clouds raining in my head. Years go by will I choke on my tears till
And welcome back, everyone. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. And the music we've been playing in and out of to breaks in the first half of today's show is music that you can find on Dr. Alicia Sulz's website. She put a personal selection up there that she feels helps people come to grips, calm themselves down, speed themselves up, whatever they need to do. Coming up next, I'm talking with Alicia Newburn. She is representing the Northwest Parkinson's Foundation, which is a nonprofit organization, and it was established to improve quality of life for the Northwest Parkinson's disease community. I want to bring Alicia on right now, and we'll find out a little bit more about the Northwest Parkinson's Foundation and the upcoming conference, which is this Saturday. Alicia Newburn, welcome.
Thank you, Vicki. Thank you very much for this opportunity.
Sure. Now, I went to the last conference that you had over in Seattle. This one is coming up this this week, and I'll be going to that too. But I want to start off with a little bit about the Northwest Parkinson's Foundation and just a high-level overview of what you do, how you got started. And I believe you got started because your founder's mother had PD. Is that right?
Absolutely, absolutely. Bill Bell and Craig Howard. These are two gentlemen's mothers were challenged with Parkinson's. And at the time, this was in 1998, there were no movement disorder specialists in the area that treated Parkinson's, that focused on Parkinson's disease. And they were frustrated at the lack of opportunities to care and education for their mothers. And so they decided to start a foundation that will be able to address that lack that we had in the community 12 years ago.
And I read, and I'm just checking it, actually, it's on the documents that you sent to me. I'd heard this before, I think, when I was at the conference last year, but more than 70,000 people in the Northwest suffer from Parkinson's disease. That seems an incredible amount of people.
It is. It is. And that we touch about 30,000 of those people, and there are 70,000 people in our area that we don't even touch. It's kind of a silent disease. It's a disease that a lot oftentimes is misdiagnosed, and a person can be challenged with it maybe 5, 6, 10 years before they get a diagnosis that this is specifically Parkinson's. Because it isn't like diabetes, where you can, as a result of a blood test, it can be determined you have diabetes based on this. Parkinson's is diagnosed through the symptoms that an individual has.
Yeah.
And it's degenerative. Sadly, at this point, there is no cure,
right.
And that is why our focus is the Northwest Parkinson's Foundation. Our focus is, while we're waiting for a cure, how can we support the Parkinson's community to have a good day today? And well, that is our focus.
That sounds great. And, you know, my mother has Parkinson's, as regular listeners will know. And Parkinson's disease can take many different forms, just like multiple sclerosis. You know, people's symptoms can be vastly different.
Absolutely.
But I want to focus, and we're going to do a medical show in a couple of months, or a couple of weeks, about Parkinson's disease but and the medical side of things. But I want to focus on the conference that you have coming up.
Yes.
Because there's still time for people to register for this.
Absolutely.
You know, health providers, people who are in the healthcare field, people who have Parkinson's, family members who, you know, want to know more about Parkinson's. Who else comes to that?
Well, friends, caregivers, care partners, anybody in the medical community, anybody that's interested in finding out what are choices that can be made to live with this challenge in their lives and have a good life. In spite of it, or in, even though you have it, to have a good life with it.
Yeah.
And actually, what we are going to, the subject matter that we're going to deal with in the conference Saturday, it will apply to people that are challenged with Parkinson's and even people that aren't challenged with Parkinson's, because the conference is going to be on the power of the mind and how we think affects how we feel. And everyone can benefit from that, but our main focus, obviously, because we've Parkinson's Foundation is for people that are challenged with Parkinson's. And just because you have this diagnosis, still can have dreams, still can make plans. We have a gentleman, Marty Hovenkotter, who is challenged with Parkinson's, and through the encouragement of another gentleman, Forrest Lane, who has Parkinson's, who decided to ride the STP last year, cycling 204 miles from Seattle to Portland. This man has Parkinson's.
Amazing.
And he did it, and he encouraged Marty to do it. So Marty is in training now. And so that is just a little example of what we do, is encourage people. You wouldn't have asked for this. It's a bummer that you have it. So what can we do with it?
Right. How can we live with it? And
Absolutely.
Interestingly enough, they're doing, and they have been doing for a number of years, studies on cycling and how that actually helps people.
It does.
With Parkinson's. I haven't managed to get my mother on a bike yet, but
well, you know, it's the Dr. Jay Alberts. Remember, he was at the conference in November.
Yes.
And he spoke about it. And at this point, there is not, my understanding from our medical director, Monique Giroux, is that they can't figure out scientifically why it works, but it does.
Yeah.
Something about the forced pedaling.
Yeah.
It helps with the symptoms.
Now, the speakers you've got coming for this conference,
yes,
it's, we should say, because we're almost at the end of our segment here, but we should say the conference runs from 10 a.m. until 2 p.m.
Correct.
Check-in and registration is at 9:30 a.m. Cost is just $15 a person and a box lunch. You get a box lunch for that.
Absolutely.
And all of this information. It's Saturday, March 5th. And again, check-in time is 9:30.
And it's at the Bellevue Hilton.
Bellevue Hilton. And people can find out more information about this at your website, which is what?
www.nwpf.org.
Great. And speakers include Dr. John Stossel, who's a professor of medicine and director of Pacific Parkinson's Research Center at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver.
Correct.
And Dr. I'm probably saying this wrong, Dr. Giroux.
Monique Giroux.
Okay. Who's the director of the Northwest Parkinson's Foundation. And Dr. Feit,
yes,
clinical psychologist in practice at the University of Washington. She currently works with people in chronic pain and fibromyalgia. So you have a really broad spectrum of people who specialize in this kind of thing. And the topic, again, is the power of the mind. Your thoughts affect how you feel. How many people do you anticipate are coming to this?
We would love, our goal is to have over 200 people come, and we still have room, and if we get over that, we will make space for everyone.
Okay.
And we want everyone to feel welcome to come. You can register by going on our website or calling us at 206-748-9481. If you don't get a chance to register, just come.
Okay.
We want the people to get the information and be encouraged.
Yes, we do. And again, your website is, please?
www.nwpf.org. www.parkinsonsdisease.org.
Okay, super. Thank you, Alicia Newburn, for being with us today from the Northwest Parkinson's Foundation, talking about the Wellness Conference, which is coming up this Saturday. The power of the mind, your thoughts affect how you feel. Thanks for being with us, Alicia.
Vicky, thank you.
Sure. We're going to go take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll be talking with Howard Gordon about his new book, which has been described as a nonstop action thriller. Please stay with us. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair.
Hi, I'm Andrea Kay, America's leading career expert. I know it's going to be a great conversation when Vicky St. Clair asked me to offer my career advice on her show. Vicky asks thoughtful questions, she's thorough, she works hard to bring you great guests who walk their talk with information and solutions that can lift your career and better your life so that you'll live well, live strong. My advice? Tune into our conversations and all the interviews on Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair for thought-provoking insight and tips on the things that really matter in your life. And visit AndreaKay.com, that's Andrea, K-A-Y.com, for information about my books and loads of free practical advice and inspiration for your career.
Do something different with your spare time. Give baby animals and paws a fresh start. With the assistance of caring volunteers, Paws helps hundreds of orphaned and sick kittens and puppies each year. Join us and save lives. Become a Paws foster care volunteer. For more information, visit paws.org or 425-787-2500. Paws.org or 425-787-2500.
You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair, talk radio to help you live well, live strong.
The new mainstream of talk radio, Alternative Talk, 1150 AM.
And welcome back, everyone. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. And my next guest, Howard Gordon, has a really interesting story to tell in more aspects than one. He's the showrunner, executive producer of the award-winning series, Emmy award-winning series 24. He's a 26-year industry veteran who's won multiple Golden Globes for his award-winning work on Fox's groundbreaking series, The X-Files. And other credits of his include Angel, Buffy the Vampire Slayer, Beauty and the Beast, Spencer for Hire, and Sisters. He graduated from Princeton University and has just fulfilled a lifelong dream. Howard Gordon, welcome.
Thank you very much for having me.
And I say you fulfilled a lifelong dream because when you were younger, you wanted to be a novelist, didn't really think it was practical. You went to Hollywood, as I understand it, to become a screenwriter, didn't really think that was practical. Said you'd give it a year and go back to law school if things didn't work out. Tell us about that.
That's right. Well, I, you know, obviously when you're young, you have a lot of thoughts about what you might want to do, and I had plenty of them. And the idea of becoming a novelist didn't seem like a very practical one from where I came from. I didn't know very many novelists, and frankly, I didn't know many screenwriters either, but I nevertheless came out to L.A. and gave it a shot and was lucky enough to begin working pretty soon after I came out here and had, between luck and hard work, just a very long and steady run up until the Writers Guild strike of 2007. So that's really where I took this long-held fantasy and actually did something about it.
And your book is called Gideon's War. You've spent 20-plus years in Hollywood writing for screen, and you know one of the biggest complaints you always hear from people when they go to the movies is, well, it was nothing like the book. But it's actually very different writing for a book than it is for writing screen, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, the... Well, it's a purer endeavor in a way because, first of all, it's much more private and intimate. You have yourself and you have a blank page, and you have an editor and a publisher and people certainly giving you notes along the way. But at the end of the day, it's really just some words on a page that a reader reads and conjures in his or her mind a story and a set of characters and a whole mood, and it lives in people's minds, you know, differently than something that's written for the screen does. I mean, a lot of the work is done for you when you're writing when you're watching a television show. You hear the music, you see the actors cast, you see them do certain things, and you're kind of a captive audience. So it's a less, I think, imagination on the end user's part plays a very much smaller role.
Mm-hmm.
So I think you need to be sensitive to that as a writer in terms of, you know, when I'm writing a screenplay or I'm writing a teleplay, it's really a blueprint for a much larger and collaborative endeavor,
yeah.
Whereas this was a very intimate experience.
Right. Now, you told us how you got your, how this novel came about, because the Writers Guild went on strike, and that gave you an opportunity to fulfill a lifelong dream there and write Gideon's War. How did you get your first break into screenwriting?
Well, I came out from Princeton with a partner at the time, a writing partner, also an aspiring novelist. So this was kind of a late night, beer soaked fantasy, frankly, coming out to Hollywood. And so we came out and we started an SAT tutoring company. And we basically catered to the privileged high school students of on the west side of Los Angeles. And anyway, we had this company, and my first student, or among my first students, was the daughter of a producer. And it was as simple as, you know, without being too forward, she knew that Alex and I were aspiring writers, and offered to have her father read our script, we'd written, and he did, and responded to it, and gave us the chance to pitch to his show, Spencer for Hire, which was a detective show in the 80s, starring Robert Urich.
I remember it, yeah. I remember it, yeah. So, and then a lot of hard work ensued after that, right, to keep
yourself
going.
Well, people, it was a very, very, it was fortuitous, and it was a fairly short, it happened pretty quickly after we came out here, and I have always told people, as lucky as you are, and I think with enough effort, enough people can find the luck to get a door open, but obviously you have to have the, you know, the energy and the talent and the wherewithal to walk through a door that's been open for you, or that you've been lucky enough to open yourself.
Right.
And even people who have that first chance, let me put it this way, there aren't a lot of people who are working in the business. There's just too much at stake for nepotism to be too active an ingredient.
Right, right.
People, I'm not going to hire my piano teacher to score my movie because I'm fond of him. The movie is very important to me. The TV show is very important to me. And ultimately, you realize you need assets and help and people who are going to help you complete the goal.
Yeah, I've heard you describe it as almost a happy accident when you actually create a great hit series like 24 or The X-Files.
Yeah, it's again, because there are so many moving parts, there are literally hundreds of things that can go wrong. You cast the wrong actor, or a director who doesn't get what you're trying to do, or the script's not right, and it's put into production prematurely. So many things can go wrong, and it only takes one of those things to make it not work. And so when something actually happens where everything goes right, it's really nothing short of a miracle.
Mm-hmm. Now, when you started writing Gideon's War, obviously you face a blank page there, and there's nobody around there to collaborate with or to, you know, hold your feet to the fire. How did you transition into that?
It was difficult. It was a very different. First of all, the lead time is a lot greater. To hear that it was due, you know, I sold the first 150 pages, and then had something like a year to complete it. And even that deadline, I wound up having to push because of my work on 24. So it was, once again, at the end of the day, a deadline that got me to finish the thing. And the tremendous, as patient as my publisher was, and she was, because she was a 24 fan and didn't want to ruin her own viewing experience on 24. But there came a point where she said, I really need the rest of this manuscript.
Right.
And so I did it. But I'm fairly disciplined in a kind of undisciplined way, is the best way I would describe it. I have like a little timer in the back of my head, and somehow I manage to get things done. I think we all do at some unconscious level. We all know that's the, you know, why is it that we're racing till the very last minute to get our taxes done, mm-hmm. you know, somehow getting to the post office, you know, 15 minutes before it closes.
Right, right.
We all have these timers in us.
Yes, yes. And sometimes that pressure pushes you to work faster anyway. But so tell us a little bit about the book, about Gideon's War. You've had some great write-ups. Tell us in your own words, if you would, a little bit about the book.
Sure. Well, the book is really about two brothers, which is an area that I've been fascinated with, a relationship. I'm one of three brothers myself, the oldest of three, and I've just forever been fascinated by that relationship. From stories of, you know, from Cain and Abel to the Godfather to the Fighter, all these, you know, it's just very charged. And I liked the idea of telling a story about kind of taking two brothers who have very different points of view in the way America prosecutes its foreign policy. One guy is a peacemaker who engages. He's actually known all over the world for having solved various conflicts. The other one is a soldier who has, you know, believes that, you know, direct force is the most expedient way to do that. And it was really the story, very simply, is about the soldier, the brother who's a covert operative, has essentially gone dark and done some unsavory things and has agreed to give himself over to the government, our government, but he'll only give himself up to his brother, who he's estranged from. So Gideon goes on this journey to this fictional Southeast Asian country to retrieve his brother, and that's really the premise of the story. Against the backdrop of this country, too, there's an insurgency that's brewing, and the brother Tillman, who's being retrieved, has presumably got some information that could mean the difference between our engagement in this war or our ability to stay out of it.
Yeah, it's actually refreshing to have your protagonist as a peacemaker.
It's also a challenge, actually. When you think about it, a lot of thrillers really have far more proactive, you know, guys who have a very, very clear idea that, you know, of what it is to be a hero. And in this case, it's a guy who's sworn to nonviolence, and that became its own trick. How do you make an active hero who refuses to pick up a gun?
Now, you said you were fascinated by the brother, the sibling rivalry, I guess, the competitiveness. Did you did any of your relationships seep into the book in any of your characters?
Yeah, I'd have to say if people have asked me this question, and I think I'm pretty close to Gideon temperamentally. I'm a guy who really does believe in engaging, you know, even to the point where I understand my own naivete, that I kind of give people the benefit of the doubt, and I can be my own worst opponent in an argument. So I definitely relate to Gideon, but I think I also recognize at a more primitive level that sometimes you have to draw a line, and sometimes that line has to be enforced by force. Mm. So I was trying to, I think, square some part of me that wars with myself in terms of what I think about America and its place in the world.
Interesting. Do you read critic reviews? You've got good. I only read good ones, but
I think I've been spared the bad ones by my publisher too. So I think I think part of it is I tend not to. But if someone's going to send me a good review, I will definitely happily glance at it.
Yeah.
But I don't look at it because I've been hurt so many times.
I always ask that question to people in the creative industry because so many of us stop, you know, put fear of rejection in our way. And you've spent 26 years in one of the most rejection-filled cultures
world. And especially with the internet, you don't have to look very far to find, you can find 100 comments on the internet after any given television episode that I've written.
Yeah,
or even 1,000 of them, and if there's 15 of them that are negative, those are the ones that will make me sleepless that night. So,
right? Do they still make you sleepless?
No, not really. But I don't look at them. I honestly have come to a place where if I'm happy, even if I'm imperfectly happy with something, that's really the only thing that I'm aspiring to. It's great when other people like it too, but if I know I've left everything on the table and done my best. And really, you know, just giving it an honest effort, then I'm happy. And whatever else comes from it, whether it's a hit or a flop, I kind of feel strangely indifferent to.
Right. Well, I can see this becoming a series. Is there another book in the works?
Mm-hmm. Which I'm already, unfortunately, have fallen behind on. But yes, I have another another one coming out, hopefully this time next year.
Well, we thank you. We thank you for taking time out of your day if you're already behind on your deadline. So that's going to come.
It's actually, well, that's another thing about writing is procrastination. Any opportunity not to write, I'll gladly take it.
Well, I actually, a while ago, found some interesting statistics on writers. People who are very, very famous literally tied themselves to the chair or went into their room naked to write and had somebody take their clothes away so they couldn't leave until they sat down and write. So but when you do procrastinate, how do you overcome that procrastination?
Really, it's just discipline. It's just sitting, recognizing the procrastination, moving through it, and saying, "Get your butt back in the chair and start writing." As painful as it is, and it's nothing more mysterious than that. It's just putting in the time.
Mm. So you're working on this book. What else are you working on right now, Howard?
I'm cutting a pilot right now that we shot. I wrote with the same partner who I came out with 25 years ago, and we split up on the X-Files in the first year, and I hired him back on 24 in the seventh season, and he and I wrote a pilot for Showtime that we shot, just finished shooting, starring Claire Danes and Damian Lewis and Mandy Patinkin. It's called Homeland. It's a thriller as well. Hopefully you'll see it next September, and I'm about to shoot a pilot for NBC called Rem, starring Jason Isaac, who you might know from the white-haired Malfoy in Harry Potter. He's a British actor.
Oh, right, yes, yeah.
And he also played in the Showtime series Brotherhood.
Yeah, yeah. So when characterization, I wanted to talk about that with you because I think you did a great job of characterizing your characters in the book. How did you go about fleshing those out?
You know, it's really it's kind of an accretion of details that you know, happens as sometimes you go forward in the plot, and as you know, in a novel too, you get these wonderful lengthy digressions to really tell a story, and so you can what would amount to in film is a lengthy flashback. You really get to dig your teeth into it. So you build out a character based on what you need and what you as deep as you want to go. And I think it's sort of in the details that that's where these things live. When you feel and taste and understand a character, sometimes it's just how in how I think how vividly and how compellingly you can describe their lives and what led them to this moment and what's going on in their head.
Yeah. I think that's what's been so compelling as well in the series you've worked on. You've always had great characters.
Well, it's a very simple. This has probably been said so many times. It's kind of a cliche, but you try to be as true as you can. When a character does something that they wouldn't do, when they know things, when they react in ways that just don't make sense to the constellation of reactions that people would have to a certain situation, and to that character in particular. You know, hopefully you have a kind of I think Hemingway called it a no bullshit detector. Hopefully, the longer you do this, the more you realize that doesn't feel honest or that doesn't feel real.
Right.
So it's something that it's a muscle you flex. And I think having done it for as long as I've been doing it, it's something I've built up over time.
Yeah. Well, I thank you for being with us today. What would you like to leave our listeners with today?
Well, I would just thank you all for listening, taking the time to listen. And I hope you like the book. I hope you'll give it a chance. I think there are a bunch of pages online that are free, and I'd love your listeners to give it a chance. It's on GideonsWar.com is the name of the website.
I was going to ask you that. Say that again. GideonsWar.com, which of course is also the same name as the book. Howard Gordon, thank you so much for being with us. I wish you even more great success.
Thank you so much.
Sure.
Bye bye.
And I want to thank each of you for being with us today. My last guest, of course, Howard Gordon, his book, Gideon's War. And you can find out more about that at his website. And I want to remind you about the Parkinson's Foundation Conference, which is coming up this Saturday, March 5th. You don't have to register, but if you do want to, just go to the Northwest Parkinson's Foundation website. It's not just for people with Parkinson's disease, because it's with, they're focusing on the power of the mind and how your thoughts affect how you feel. And I know from the, if it's anything like the last conference I went to, there were over 700 people there, and they did an outstanding job of presenting information. And if you missed any of that, you can always give me a call at 800-495-7617. 800-495-7617, or email at conversationslive.net, info@conversationslive.net. And we'll be back next week. Thanks for being with us today. Until then, live well, live strong.